I've horrified you. I know it. I can tell. You're trembling, aren't you?
Well, welcome to Visigoth's bedtime story number 15. Don't ask me where the other 14 are. And based on the book I've alluded to quite often, and that is Leonard Peikoff's The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America. And on the verge of the administration that takes over next year, not that, you know, no big deal, it's democratic, but we are going to get further socialized, Sovietized, but you like to call it federalized, and that's okay. Well, the state's going to have a capital T and a capital S in the next few years, and it's going to get worse. So just understand that this is a bit of an anatomy of how we got here. I'm not going to read the whole book. I'm just going to hit it here and there, but I think, you know, hopefully just hitting the salient points, although I think this book is quite excellent. I will, you know, Leonard Peikoff is not a Christian. He doesn't like religion. And that's fine, just as long as you know that, but the information is good. He is probably a proponent somewhat of Ayn Rand's objectivism. I don't hold that against him either. It's just that he wrote a very startling account of the way things are going to be, were going to be, and now are happening. He did this back in 1982. That should mean something to you. All right, so here we go from the first paragraph, the cause of Nazism. The Nazis did not gain power against the country's wishes. In this respect, there was no gulf between the intellectuals and the people. The Nazi Party was elected to office by the freely cast ballots of millions of German voters, including men on every social, economic, and educational level. In the national election of July 1932, the Nazis obtained 37% of the vote and a plurality of seats in the Reichstag. On January 30, 1933, in full accordance with the country's legal and constitutional principles, Hitler was appointed chancellor. 5 weeks later, in the last, and in parentheses it has, and semi-free election, of the pre-totalitarian period, the Nazis obtained 17 million votes, 44% of the total. The voters were aware of the Nazi ideology. Nazi literature, including statements of the Nazi plans for the future, papered the country during the years, the last years of the Weimar Republic. Mein Kampf alone sold more than 200,000 copies between 1925 and 1932. The essence of the political system which Hitler intended to establish in Germany was clear. In 1933, when Hitler did establish the system he had promised, he did not find it necessary to forbid foreign travel. Until World War II, those Germans who wished to flee the country could do so. The overwhelming majority did not. They were satisfied to remain. The system which Hitler established, the social reality which so many Germans were so eager to embrace and so willing to endure, the politics which began in a theory and ended in Auschwitz, was the total state. The term from which the adjective totalitarian derives was coined by Hitler's mentor, Mussolini. The state must have absolute power over every man and over every sphere of human activity, the Nazis declared. Quote, the authority of the Führer is not limited by checks and controls, by special autonomous bodies or individual rights, but it is free and independent, all-inclusive and unlimited, said Ernst Huber, an official party spokesman in 1933. Another quote, the concept of personal liberties of the individual as opposed to the authority of the state had to disappear. It is not to be reconciled with the principle of the nationalistic Reich, said Huber to a country which listened and nodded. Picking up the quote again, there are no personal liberties of the individual which fall outside of the realm of the state and which must be respected by the state. The constitution of the nationalistic Reich is therefore not based upon a system of inborn and inalienable rights of the individual. That's the end of the quote. If the term statism designates concentration of power in the state at the expense of individual liberty, then Nazism in politics was a form of statism. In principle, it did not represent a new approach to government. It was a continuation of the absolute of political absolutism. The absolute monarchies, the oligarchies, the theocracies, the random tyrannies, which had characterized most of human history. In degree, however, the total state does differ from its predecessors. It represents statism pressed to its limits, in theory and in practice, devouring the last remnants of the individual. although previous dictators, and in parentheses, and many today, ergo in Latin America, and in parentheses, often preached the unlimited power of the state, they were on the whole unable to enforce such power. As a rule, citizens of such countries had a kind of partial freedom, not a freedom on principle, but at least a freedom by default. Even the latter was effectively absent in Nazi Germany. The efficiency of the government in dominating its subjects, the all-encompassing character of its coercion, the complete mass regimentation on a scale involving millions of men, and one might add, the enormity of the slaughter, the planned systematic mass slaughter in peacetime initiated by a government against its own citizens, these are the insignia of 20th century totalitarianism, Nazi and communist, which are without parallel in recorded history. In the totalitarian regimes that the Germans found out after only a few months of Hitler's rule, every detail of life is prescribed or proscribed. There is no longer any distinction between private matters and public matters. Quote, there are to be no more private Germans, said Friedrich Seeberg, a Nazi writer, picking up the quote, each is to attain significance only by his service to the state and to find complete self-fulfillment in this service. The only person who is still a private individual in Germany, boasted Robert Ley, a member of the Nazi hierarchy after several years of Nazi rule, is somebody who is asleep. In place of the despised private individuals, the Germans heard daily or hourly about a different kind of entity, a supreme entity, whose will, it was said, is what determines the course and actions of the state, the nation, the whole, the group. Over and over, the Germans heard the idea that underlies the advocacy of omnipotent government, the idea that totalitarians of every kind stressed as the justification of their total states, collectivism. Collectivism is the theory that the group, or the collective, has primacy over the individual. Collectivism holds that, in the human affairs, the collective, society, the community, the nation, the proletariat, the race, etc., is the unit of reality and the standard of value. On this view, the individual has reality only as a part of the group, and value only insofar as he serves it. On his own, he has no political rights. He is to be sacrificed for the group whenever it, or its representative, the state, deems this desirable. Fascism, said one of its leading spokesmen, Alfredo Rocco, stresses, and this is a block quote, the necessity for which the older doctrine makes little allowance of sacrifice, even up to the total immolation of individuals in behalf of the society. For liberalism, that is individualism, the individual is the end and society the means. Nor is it conceivable that the individual, considered in the dignity of an ultimate finality, be lower to mere instrumentality. For fascism, society is the end, individuals the means, and its whole life consists in using individuals as instruments for its social ends. That's the end of the block quote. We pick up with another quote. The higher interest involved in the life of the whole, said Hitler in a 1933 speech, must here set the limits and lay down the duties of the interests of the individual. And that's the end of the quote. Men echoed the Nazis. Have to realize that the state is more important than the individual, that individuals must be willing and ready to sacrifice themselves for nation and Führer. The people said the Nazis, form a true organism, a living unity, whose cells are individual persons. In reality, therefore, appearances to the contrary notwithstanding, there is no such thing as an isolated individual or an autonomous man. Just as the individual is to be regarded merely as a fragment of the group, the Nazis said, so his positions are to be regarded as a fragment of the group's wealth. Private property, and this is another block quote from Huber, private property as conceived under the liberalistic economic order was a reversal of the true concept of property. This private property represented the rights of the individual to manage and to speculate with inherited or acquired property as he pleased, without regard for general interests. German socialism had to overcome this private, that is, unrestrained and irresponsible view of property. All property is common property. The owner is bound by the people and the right to the responsible management of his goods. His legal position is only justified when he satisfies this responsibility to the community. Contrary to the Marxists, the Nazis did not advocate public ownership of the means of production. They did demand that the government oversee and run the nation's economy. The issue of legal ownership, they explained, is secondary. What counts is the issue of control. Private citizens, therefore, may continue to hold titles to property so long as the state reserves to itself the unqualified right to regulate the use of their property. If ownership means the right to determine the use and disposal of material goods, then Nazism endowed the state with every real prerogative of ownership. But the individual retained was merely a formal deed, a contentless deed, which conferred no rights upon its holder. Under communism, there is collective ownership of property de jure. Under Nazism, there is the same collective ownership de facto. During the Hitler years, in order to finance the party's programs, including the war expenditures, every social group in Germany was mercilessly exploited and drained. White-collar salaries and the earnings of small businessmen were deliberately held down by government controls, freezes, taxes. Big business was bled by taxes and special contributions of every kind and strangled by the bureaucracy. Amid the Niagara of thousands of special decrees and laws, writes Shire, even the most astute businessman was often lost, and special lawyers had to be employed to enable a firm to function. The graft involved in finding one's way to key officials became in the late 30s astronomical. That's the end of the quote. At the same time, the income of the farmers was held down, and there was a desperate flight to the cities, where the middle class, especially the small tradesmen, were soon in desperate straits, and where the workers were forced to labor at low wages for increasingly long hours, up to 60 or more per week. But the Nazis defended their policies and the country did not rebel. It accepted the Nazi argument. Selfish individuals may be unhappy, the Nazis said, but what we have established in Germany is the ideal system, socialism. In its Nazi usage, this term is not restricted to a theory of economics. It is to be understood in a fundamental sense. Socialism for the Nazis denotes the principle of collectivism as such and its corollary, statism, in every field of human action, including but not limited to economics. To be a socialist, says Goebbels, is to submit to the I, to the thou. Socialism is sacrificing the individual to the whole. By this definition, the Nazis practice what they preach. They practice it at home and then abroad. No one can claim that they did not sacrifice enough individuals. The question is, why? What would explain a system such as Nazism? What permitted it to happen? An evil of such magnitude cannot be a product of superficial factors. In order to make it, in its German popularity, intelligible, one must penetrate to its deepest, most hidden roots. One must grasp its nature and its causes in terms of fundamentals. Unfortunately, this has not been the approach of most observers. As a rule, commentators have attempted to explain Nazism by the opposite method, by the newspaper headlines or the practical crisis of the moment. It has been said, for instance, that the Germans embraced Nazism because they lost World War I. Austria lost that war also, but this did not cause them to turn to Nazism. It went under only when invaded by Hitler in 1938. Italy, on the other hand, one of the victorious powers at the Versailles Conference of 1919, went fascist in 1922. It has been said that the cause of Nazism was the Great Depression. All the industrial nations suffered the ravages of the Depression. Few turned to Nazism. It has been said that the cause of Nazism was the weakness of the non-totalitarian parties in the Weimar Republic, the pressure group warfare which they encouraged, and the governmental paralysis that followed. This does not explain why or in what basic respect the non-totalitarians were weak, nor does it take into account that the many countries in which social clashes and government drifting have not led to Nazism. There is no direct causal relationship or even any approximate correlation between specific practical crises, singly or in combination, and the development of Nazism. Practical crises confront a country with the need for action. They do not determine what the action will be. In the face of military ruin, economic strangulation, or governmental collapse, men may choose to investigate the disaster's causes and to discover a more rational course of action for the future. That is, they may choose to think. Or they may choose to hate, or to pray, or to beg, or to kill. On such matters, the crisis itself is silent. There are other interpretations of Nazism besides the practical crisis theory. Religious writers often claim that the cause of Nazism is the secularism or the scientific spirit of the modern world. This evades the facts that the Germans at the time, especially in Prussia, were one of the most religious peoples in Western Europe, that the Weimar Republic was a hotbed of mystic cults of which Nazism was one, and that Germany's largest and most devout religious group, the Lutherans, counted themselves among Hitler's staunchest followers. There is the Marxist interpretation of Nazism, according to which Hitler is the inevitable result of capitalism. This evades the facts that Germany after Bismarck was the least capitalistic country of Western Europe, that the Weimar Republic from the start was a controlled economy with the controls growing steadily, and that the word Nazism is an abbreviation for National Socialism. There are the Aryan racists in reverse who say that the cause of Nazism is the innate depravity of the Germans. This evades the fact that depravity is a moral concept, which implies that man is not predetermined but has free choice. It also evades the fact that regimes similar to Hitler's, regimes differing only in the degree of their brutality, differing only in the degree of brutality they perpetuated, have appeared in our century across the globe, not only in Italy, Japan, Argentina, and the like, but also in the form of communism in Russia, China, and their satellites. Then there is the Freudian interpretation, according to which the cause of Nazism is the Germans' Oedipus complex, or their death wish, or their toilet training, etc. This evades the fact that arbitrary constructs, such as Freud is famous for, can be manipulated to explain anything, and therefore explains nothing. We dare not brush aside unexplained a horror such as Nazism. Many writers have noted similarities between America today and Germany before Hitler, then have shrugged off their own observations, succumbing to the notion, spread by today's intellectuals, that it is bad history to compare two different countries. This notion, itself a symptom of our current crisis, means that there are no principles governing human action, and that is bad history to learn from. The similarities, however, cannot be shrugged off. Our crisis is real. The crisis is the fact that our country, the United States of America, the freest, the most productive, and the most moral country in the world, is now moving in Hitler's direction. America is moving toward a Nazi form of totalitarianism. It has been doing this for decades. It has been doing so gradually, by default, and for the most part unknowingly, but it is doing so systematically and without significant opposition. In every cultural area, from science and education to art and religion to politics and economics, the trend is now unmistakable. There are differences between America and the Weimar Republic. Our future, as far as one can judge, is still indeterminate. But the current trend will not be checked unless we grasp, in terms of essential, the ominous parallels between the two countries, and above all, the basic cause behind those parallels. If we are to avoid a fate like that of Germany, we must find out what made such a fate possible. We must find out, at root, is required to turn a country, Germany or any other, into a Nazi dictatorship, and then we must uproot that root. We need to look for something deeper than practical conditions, something that dictates men's view of what constitutes the practical. In an advanced, civilized country, a handful of men were able to gain for their criminal schemes the enthusiastic backing of millions of decent, educated, law-abiding citizens. What is the factor that made this possible? Criminal groups and schemes have existed throughout history in every country. They have been able to succeed only in certain periods. The mere presence of such groups is not sufficient to account for their victory. Something made so many Germans so vulnerable to a takeover. Something armed the criminals and disarmed the country. Observe in this connection that the Nazis, correctly, regarded the power of propaganda as an indispensable tool. The Nazis could not have won the support of the German masses but for the systematic preaching of a complex array of theories, doctrines, opinions, notions, beliefs. And not one of their central beliefs was original. They found those beliefs widespread and waiting in the culture. They seized upon them and broadcast them at top volume, thrusting them with a new intensity back into the streets of Germany. And the men in the streets heard and recognized and sympathized with and embraced those beliefs and voted for their exponents. The Germans would not have recognized or embraced those beliefs in the 19th century when the West was still being influenced by the remnants of the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment, when the doctrines of the rights of man and the autonomy of the individual were paramount. But by the 20th century, such doctrines and the convictions on which they depended were paramount no longer. Germany was ideologically ripe for Hitler. The intellectual groundwork had been prepared. The country's ideas, a certain special category of ideas, were ready. There is a science whose subject matter is that category of ideas. Today, in our colleges, this science has sunk to the lowest point in its history. Its teachers have declared that it has no questions to ask, no method to follow, no answers to offer. As a result, it is disappearing, losing its identity, its intelligibility, its students, and the last vestiges of its once noble reputation. No one, among the intellectuals or the general public, would suspect any longer that this science could be relevant to human life or action. Yet this science determines the destiny of nations and the course of history. It is the source of a nation's frame of reference and code of values, the root of a people's character and culture, the fundamental cause shaping men's choices and decisions in every crucial area of their lives. It is the science which directs men to embrace this world or to seek out some other that is said to transcend it, which directs them to reason or superstition, to the pursuit of happiness or of self-sacrifice, to production or starvation, to freedom or slavery, to life or death. It is the science which made the difference between the East and the West, between the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, between the founding fathers of the new continent and the Adolf Hitlers of old. It is the science which had to be destroyed if the catastrophes of our time were to become possible. The science is philosophy. Philosophy is the study of the nature of existence, of knowledge, and of values. The branch of philosophy that studies existence is metaphysics. Metaphysics identifies the nature of the universe as a whole. It tells men what kind of world they live in and whether there is a supernatural dimension beyond it. It tells men whether they live in a world of solid entities, natural laws, absolute facts, or in a world of illusory fragments, unpredictable miracles, and ceaseless flux. It tells men whether the things they perceive by their senses and mind form a comprehensive reality with which they can deal, or some kind of unreal appearance which leaves them staring and helpless. The branch of philosophy that studies knowledge is epistemology. Epistemology identifies the proper means of acquiring knowledge. It tells men which mental processes to employ as methods of cognition and which to reject as invalid or deceptive. Above all, epistemology tells men whether reason is their faculty of gaining knowledge, and if so, how it works, or whether there is a means of knowledge other than reason, such as faith, or the instinct of society, or the feelings of the dictator. The branch of philosophy that studies values is ethics, or morality, which rests on both the above branches, on a view of the world in which man acts, and of man's nature, including his means of knowledge. Ethics defines a code of values to guide human actions. It tells men the proper purpose of man's life and the means of achieving it. It provides the standard by which men are to be judged good or evil, right or wrong, the desirable and the undesirable. Ethics tells a man, for instance, to pursue his own fulfillment or to sacrifice himself for the sake of something else, such as God or his neighbor. The branch of philosophy that applies ethics to social questions is politics, which studies the nature of social systems and the proper functions of government. Politics is not the start, but the product of a philosophic system. By their nature, political questions cannot be raised or judged except on the basis of some view of existence, of values, and of man's proper means of knowledge. Since men cannot live or act without some kind of basic guidance, the issues of philosophy in some form necessarily affect every man in every social group and class. Most men, however, do not consider such issues in explicit terms. They absorb their ideas implicitly, eclectically, and with many contradictions from the cultural atmosphere around them, building into their souls without identifying it the various ideological vibrations emanating from school and church and arts and media and mores. A cultural atmosphere is not a primary. It is created ultimately by a handful of men, by those whose life work is to deal with, originate, and propagate fundamental ideas. For the great majority of men, the influence of philosophy is indirect and unrecognized, but it is real. The root cause of Nazism lies in a power that most people ignore, disparage, and underestimate. The cause is not the events hailed or cursed in headlines and street rallies, but the esoteric writings of the professors who, decades or centuries earlier, laid the foundation for those events. The symbol of the cause is not the munitions plant or union halls or bank vaults of Germany, but its ivory towers. What came out of the towers in this regard is only coils of obscure, virtually indecipherable jargon, but that jargon is fatal. The Nazi death camps, notes a writer in the New York Times, were conceived, built, and often administered by PhDs. That's the end of the quote. What had those PhDs been taught to think in their schools and universities, and where did such ideas come from? Okay, we'll leave it right there. That has come from, that's the first chapter of The Ominous Parallels, The End of Freedom in America, published in 1982, written by Leonard Peikoff. And yeah, I've made mention of this book several times because of what it stated and when it stated it. And I think this work, more than anything else, just puts on the table the fact that, you know, we have become supposedly that which we hated, and we don't realize it because, of course, you know, in America, it's 11, you know, doesn't make any, you know, If we do it in America, it's okay. And there you have it. So that'll be the end of Visigoth's bedtime story, number 15, and we will pick up with this. I'm not really sure which chapter I'm going to go to, but I just want to get the meat, and I ask you just to think about what you heard just then. We'll see you later.
These are horrible stories. Don't you understand? They frighten me and Polly. No, I grow too tired now. Goodbye.